At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In no way should you take this personally, but you remember that slight buzz of economic optimism that's been out there for a couple of weeks? Yeah, it pretty much went away this morning. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice, over 10,000 independent insurance agencies across America committed to treating customers as people, not policies, online at trustedchoice.com. American Public Media brings you 4 documentaries about the economic crisis, supported by the University of Virginia's Batten Institute. More at AmericanRadioWorks.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 13th of May. It's a Wednesday, and it is great to have you here. I think what we're going to do today is a little participatory public radio. So, repeat after me. Consumer spending, come on, you can say it. Consumer spending accounts for 70% of the American economy. So the news this morning that retail sales fell once again last month landed with an enormous thud. There have been hopes, as I said, that things are beginning to turn around, but Ashley Milne-Tite reports now from New York that it's going to take more than just hope.
The way Citigroup economist Stephen Whiting sees it, everyone got a little drunk on hopeful economic indicators. So today's news means one heck of a headache. He says, yes, rising unemployment plays a role in cutting consumer demand, but it's only part of the problem.
We have perhaps a 3% decline in total employment in the United States, but the declines in durable goods expenditures in the year through 1Q were 10%. People who fear losing their jobs hold back on their expenditures, not just people who have actually lost their jobs.
People like Desiree Jennings. She and her husband have 2 mortgages and their savings have taken a hit, but they have no credit card debt and they both earn 6 figures. Jennings says she could go shopping, but all the media gloom has terrified her.
We're very conscious now of our spending. The fear has just gotten to the point where we second guess whether or not we should spend $20 on a pair of running shorts, for example.
They're saving more than usual, too. Carrie Leahy of Decision Economics says so are a lot of other people. He says spending may pick up, but consumers will continue to choose carefully, which isn't good news for retailers.
If your underlying demand for the kind of things you sell has diminished, there's very little you can do other than to keep cutting costs, and ultimately you just may have to go out of business because there's just too many of you selling to too few of them.
He says retailers need to redesign themselves for a leaner buying landscape. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The world's biggest computer chip maker got slammed with the world's biggest antitrust fine today. The European Union fined Intel almost $1.5 billion for what it calls illegal sales tactics. Intel and its main rival AMD have been tussling over that issue for years, as Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
If you have a PC, chances are good that Intel made the chips that make it work. The company controls at least 70% of the market, but it's not in trouble for being the biggest. It's in trouble for allegedly abusing its plum position. The EU charges that Intel acted unfairly to squeeze out AMD. Eleanor Fox is a law professor at NYU.
Intel inaugurated a lot of practices that would tend to keep the customers buying from Intel and not buying from AMD.
Like offering steep rebates to customers who bought only Intel chips and paying computer makers to delay the launch of products containing chips made by Intel's rivals. Richard Donovan co-chairs the antitrust law practice at Kelly, Dry & Warren in New York. He says what Intel did would be illegal on either side of the Atlantic.
We call it monopolization, whereas in the European Union and some other countries, they call it an abuse of dominance. But it's the same thing and very much the same kind of standard.
Intel's under investigation by the Federal Trade Commission and the New York Attorney General's office. The new head of antitrust at the Department of Justice, Christine Varney, signaled this week the Obama administration will be tougher on antitrust questions. Again, Richard Donovan.
She took the occasion to emphasize that under her administration, they were going to look more closely at monopolists and monopolistic activity.
Intel says it will appeal the EU ruling. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There was a grim assessment from the African Development Bank today that the rate of Africa's economic growth will fall by more than half this year. On the world's poorest continent, that could mean a real crisis, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Africa has been hit hard, the bank says. It's not that the continent as a whole is in recession, but it's seen a sharp fall in the rate of growth. Per capita income is expected to increase by only 2% or so in 2009, the lowest level for 15 years. Patrick Smith, editor of Africa Confidential magazine.
It's due almost entirely to the failure of the markets in the West. Those are the markets for Africa's key export commodities, both the agricultural commodities and the oil and gas and the mineral exports.
Over the past decade, the African economy has grown at around 5% a year, thanks to the booming demand for commodities and to a general improvement in economic management. That could be in jeopardy, says Todd Moss of the Center for Global Development.
The long-term issue is whether Africa is going to turn its back on some of the economic reforms that were the basis of the positive performance more recently.
The downturn poses a political and social threat, says Patrick Smith. The collapse in the price of commodities could deprive every African of $250 a year of income, a catastrophic decline in some countries.
There are some economies where the average per capita income per head is well under $500 a year. So you're looking at a substantial problem looming in Africa.
He says that problem may only be averted if the global economy begins to recover early next year. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, no recovery at all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As we learned from today's retail sales report, consumers just aren't feeling any economic love. And anyway, a lot of retailers have already moved on. They're already thinking about fall and back-to-school shopping. There's a lot at stake, too, because back-to-school sales are second only to the winter holidays as a portion of retailers' incomes. For store buyers, this is actually a pretty good time. It's their first chance since the recession took hold to use what they've learned about how shoppers have changed and tailor their inventories to a down economy. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has that story.
Shopping has become all about the waiting game. You see something you want, and you wait, while the price drops, and drops, and drops. Things got that way because when the recession hit, retailers were sitting on piles of inventory they'd ordered when we were still spending with abandon. To get rid of all that merchandise, stores had to slash prices. Candace Corlett heads up WSL Strategic Retail. She says stores are cutting orders way back for fall and looking for ways to break consumers of their discount addiction.
Back-to-school season is the first season where retailers have really had to face the reality check and say, this is a whole different shopper out there.
Corlett says consumers are now taking a moment to think before they buy. Sounds kind of un-American, But in a nationwide survey, Corlett's company found nearly three-quarters of shoppers were giving their purchases more thought, like hairdresser Monica Wood. At an outdoor mall in Los Angeles, she says she's trained herself to stop and think.
I'm a big spend in the minute. Like, I see it and I love it. And then I get home and, like, I have five more just like it. I do think about my purchases more. I think about what I have at home.
This is the biggest change in consumer behavior in at least 50 years.
Nancy Cohn is a retail historian at Harvard. She says the shift is not just about saving money. We're completely rethinking how we spend. Remember those frenzies at H&M and Forever 21 where shoppers snapped up cheap fashions by the armload? Cohn says that brand of disposable fast fashion is going out of style.
I mean, we did more is better for 15 years and look where it got us. As a consumer saying, I want to work with retailers that seem to have something of quality and worth that reflects the hard-earned money that I put into buying that good or service.
Cohn says those shoppers are now willing to pay more for things that will last. And while they are headed upmarket, there's another group of shoppers taking a step down. Those who used to outfit themselves and their families at high-end stores like Banana Republic and Nordstrom's, places they can no longer afford. Again, retail analyst Candace Corlett.
We're definitely seeing a waterfall where shoppers are leaving higher price chains to find stylish merchandise in lower price chains.
And those lower priced chains are greeting them with trendier and sometimes more expensive merchandise. Kohl's has commissioned a line from MTV fashion plate Lauren Conrad. JCPenney just rolled out new fashions from Allen B. and iHeart Ronson.
We're stepping up our style with new exclusive designer collections.
The new lines are some of the priciest in the store. Jeans for $80, short shorts for $40. Stephen Lawrence is an apparel manager for Penney's. He says the move upmarket is risky, but the recession is an opportunity.
As we're seeing the consumer not be able to afford some of the luxury goods that they had in the past, giving them some of those styles at prices that they can afford was a viable space for us to play in.
At a JCPenney in Glendale, California, women's apparel manager Eva Figueroa straightens a leopard print display for Kimora Lee Simmons' new Fabulosity line. She says the new designers are luring the boutique set into the store.
When they come in, they go, oh, you know, we didn't know that you carry that label. And they make comments that, you know, the prices is pretty good versus what they used to pay in other stores.
Good enough that some of the lines are starting to sell out. And that's what retailers are banking on for the fall. That if they choose their inventory wisely, consumers who try to play the waiting game will find that by the time they're ready to spend, there's nothing left to buy. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
House Democrats say they've come to terms on a climate change bill. They've cut back on some of the more aggressive parts of their original plan so they can get the thing passed by Memorial Day. Still, the revised bill does lay out a pretty ambitious agenda. It reduces greenhouse gas emissions 17% by the year 2020. Also, it increases the amount of power that's produced using renewable resources. Commentator David Frum says that all sounds pretty good, but the approach is all wrong.
Barack Obama's responsibility era has lasted barely 4 months. On Monday, the president stood in the East Room of the White House with leading healthcare executives to announce $2 trillion in hypothetical, and probably imaginary, savings in health spending over the coming decade. His revenue side is revealing itself as even more of a fantasy. The Obama administration has been counting on big revenues from its climate change plans. It would sell permits to emit carbon dioxide, which is generated by burning fossil fuels like oil and coal. The administration reckoned the value of these permits at somewhere between $700 billion and $1.8 trillion over 10 years. But that estimate was always based on disregarding the giant favor-selling machine we know as the United States Congress. The last round of carbon legislation in Congress, back in 2007, ended up giving large emission rights away for free to powerful interest groups. The interests have not got any weaker since. Which is why, as the current legislation moves through Congress, more and more of the permits are again being given away for free, up to 75% in the versions of the bill being debated this week. Environmentalists go along with the giveaway because they get something they want, a mandate on utilities to use costly wind and solar, and to pass the cost on to consumers. Consumers will pay more for electricity, but instead of paying it to the U.S. Treasury, they will pay it to utility companies. All of this was predictable from the start. More than predictable. Predicted. Democrats rejected the simple and rational alternative, a tax on carbon dioxide, in favor of a complex system of permits and mandates. Democrats preferred a more interventionist approach because it gives government more power to favor pet technologies like wind and solar over lower-cost nuclear. And as any utility can tell you, power costs money.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Your thoughts are always welcome. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, you still dream of that white picket fence?
Every single person in this country pinning their hopes on one single family home is just not reasonable, and we just can't supply that really across the country.
Designing a new vision of home, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 2.1% today, 184 points, closed at 8,284. The NASDAQ deflated 3%, 51 points, finished at 1,664. The S&P 500 closed down 2.2%, 24 points, 883, the number there. Hard on the heels of those retail sales numbers we mentioned earlier, Macy's reported today. News of an $88 million first quarter loss pushed the company's stock down more than 6.5% today. Target fell more than 4.75%. Nike ran down more than 2.75%. Intel dropped 0.5% after it was fined $1.5 billion in Europe. As we mentioned, AMD nudged up 0.6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 3.1%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. American Public Media programs explore the American dream and ask, after our current troubles are over, what's next? More at nextamericandream.org. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Plastic is the subject of President Obama's town hall meeting in New Mexico. Plastic in the form of credit cards. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the producer price index for April. And on May 14, 1973, Skylab was out of this world. The nation's first space station and laboratory was launched into Earth orbit. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Since at least the Second World War, a big part of the American dream has been owning your own house. Often, that meant one out in the suburbs. 65 years on, the Census Bureau says the vast majority of young, college-educated couples in this country still leave cities once they have children. They're looking for good public schools and affordable housing, two things that haven't always been easy to find with city life. In today's installment of our series, The Next American Dream, sustainability reporter Sam Eaton tells us that a growing number of young families are moving back into town anyway.
It was in Kansas City that Emily Lauterbach and Andrew Ginsberg discovered how quickly the American dream of home ownership can slip into a nightmare.
We got married, and then we bought a house, and then we had a baby,
And then the whole world fell apart.
Virtually overnight, layoffs transformed their once gentrifying inner-city neighborhood into a sea of foreclosed houses. Whatever hope they'd had for the area vanished. The stray pit bulls and corner drug deals no longer qualified as neighborhood charm, especially now that they had a toddler to worry about. So Emily and Andrew put their $65,000 Craftsman on the market and skipped town.
Our goal now is to not own that house. We'd really like to get rid of it.
This is the stage when most young families trade their cramped urban lifestyles for the affordable space, safety, and schools of the suburbs. Emily and Andrew considered moving to Lincoln, Nebraska, Emily's hometown. But then they thought better of it and chose Chicago instead after Andrew was offered a job there as a labor organizer.
These are hot, hot eggs.
Hot eggs.
So today they live in an airy two-bedroom apartment on Chicago's north side. It's the bottom half of an historic duplex surrounded by trees and nearby parks. And the only reason they can afford to live here is because they're renting. In fact, they swore never to own a house again.
I mean, I do think that we just, like, bought into this whole thing. Like, you know, you make an investment and you make your payments, and that's what responsible people do, and you keep up your yard. And it's not the way we look at things anymore, you know? Like, we live in a big city with thriving neighborhoods, and there's lots of places that we can rent from, and someone else can do all those things, and we can pay them.
Leaving Andrew and Emily, who's now a stay-at-home mom, with more time to raise their son Eli as a savvy city kid. A childhood they both wish they could have had. But even for the most determined families, trading the American dream's suburban comforts for life in the city isn't always easy.
For the most part, cities have repelled this population.
Joel Kotkin is author of The City, A Global History.
Most cities today are not interested in their middle class. They're interested in hip, cool young people who eventually grow up and leave. Their endless quest for the empty nesters and the poor. And that's what they do.
Often pushing the issues that matter most to middle-class families, things like parks, playgrounds, and schools, to the bottom of city priorities. And that keeps Emily up at night.
I know that when it's time for us to pick a school, we're going to have a lot of fights. I think that if somehow we can't get Eli into a public school that I think will give him enough opportunities, I would be happy to pay for school for him.
I can't believe you said that on the radio. I don't know. I think kind of for the same reason, I think you should stay in the city and pay taxes so the city can be good. I think you should go to the public schools. And that will never, ever change my mind unless I become a different person.
University of Illinois urban planning professor Robert Brugman says this is one of the most challenging dilemmas facing families with school-aged children in Chicago.
We have the honor of having what are arguably the worst schools in the country by most objective standards.
And that's not going to change anytime soon. But Brugman says as more middle-class families choose to stay, new models arise.
The experimentation is really vigorous. We have all kinds of new options in charter schools, in magnet schools, in parochial schools, so that there's no longer this feeling of hopelessness. Now you have a lot of choices on what you can do.
But even those choices can be a tough sell for parents who mostly grew up in the suburbs and in small towns.
Hi there. Glad you got here.
Sorry we're late.
Yeah. Emily's extended family still gathers at her grandmother's Lincoln, Nebraska home every year for Easter.
Let's go look under the tree. Come on, buddy.
After an early dinner, Emily and her family watch Eli run through the backyard with his cousins searching for Easter eggs. Of the entire bunch, Emily is the only one who chose to live in the big city, a decision even she sometimes questions.
We've been pretty easy to move back here. We have a support system and could have lived in the house I grew up in, and I knew the neighborhood, and we have a lot of family friends, so it would have been easy to get a job and know people.
Eli's education would have been easy as well. Emily's old elementary school is just a few blocks away. Unlike Chicago, she says here there's one choice, and it happens to be a good one. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Just as people like Emily and Andrew are rethinking home ownership, architects and developers are rethinking the home. Smaller, closer to the neighbors, ideally close to a train station, too. All right, so why don't you tell us where we are?
Well, we are here at the Mission Station in South Pasadena. We're heading north to a project that we built that is a mixed-use project. That is to say, it's a retail area, it's got some housing, and it's got some parking for park and ride.
Architect Elizabeth Moll lives and works in Pasadena, California, a short hop on the freeway or a slightly longer train ride from downtown L.A. For her, the subprime crisis and all those foreclosures out there is really an opportunity to rethink the home and how it ought to be built.
What we're looking at is a brick building in front, and we've got a little florist and a bakery here on the ground floor with some outdoor seatings.
On the second floor, you've got huge windows. And lofts inside, I suppose, right?
That's right. And then as we're going down the street, we've created a series of bungalow courts that are relatively high density but fit into the neighborhood.
And South Pass is a great city for these kinds of things because it's got lots of parks, it does have the good schools.
A lot of big cities, though, that have some other problems might not be as amenable to this kind of living, no?
Well, I think that, personally, hope springs eternal. I think every city can be accommodated and transformed into a place like this that has a lot of housing and offices around transit. It's important we talk about housing and offices around transit, because what we've got to get to is a jobs-housing balance.
There's a little bit of a marketing problem here, right? Because when you start talking about density of living and getting more people in the same spot and, you know, just in a description, it doesn't maybe sell.
Well, I think the reason I took you over here is that this is not the picture that most people have of density, but it's dense enough. If the single-family house is, say, about 5 to 7 DUs an acre, dwelling units per acre, now we're looking at something that might be 20, 25, 30, but it doesn't really look or feel very different than a single-family house.
But we are so invested in this country, in single-family homes, the yard, the mortgage, and all of that, that it sort of is an uphill fight for you.
Yeah. Now, everybody loves single-family houses, but frankly, they've been oversupplied dramatically. And what's been undersupplied are other ways of life allowing you to walk places, jump on a train instead, and save a lot of time, because every single person in this country pinning their hopes on one single-family home is just not reasonable, and we just can't supply that really across the country.
As the demand, though, for this kind of living increases, isn't that going to drive up prices and then make it perhaps not as affordable as it might ideally be?
Yes, but it's important to remember that when you're building more units on a smaller piece of land, it is essentially more affordable than putting one home on the same piece of land. I think one could really argue that it's a way to provide more affordable housing than the other way around.
So much of this discussion is about sustainability and how we can do that. What does that really mean, though?
Well, the main thing about sustainability is we need to be thinking about places that we're going to make that are permanent, because the greatest use of resources are resources over time. They have to be used by lots of different functions over time. They can't be single-use buildings. That's one. They have to be more walkable, and they have to be compact and mixed use, because when you look at the energy consumption of a single-family house or any single building, buildings are already the greatest user of energy. But when you add the commuting to that building, you actually increase the energy usage by 50%. 50%. But the main thing is, we just need common sense. We don't need new technologies to make this. We need to make them simple. We need to make them compact and pedestrian oriented.
To make all this work, do we have to get used to the idea of giving up the car?
I think a lot of people are dying to get rid of their cars and to get out of them. You know, the fact is that we've made lives where we just drive from one place to another, back and forth, and our lives are largely led now in our cars, and we don't have enough time for our children. We don't have enough time for our marriages. I don't think, speaking as a working mother, that I had children in order to spend all my afternoons in a car.
Elizabeth Mole is the principal architect at the firm Mole and Polizoides in Pasadena, California. You can see what mixed-use buildings and their neighborhoods can look like, and you can hear other pieces from our series, The Next American Dream, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, you remember how the credit markets seized up last year because of trillions of dollars worth of bets, in effect, that banks had made with derivatives like credit default swaps? They were basically insurance against other investments going bad, and they tied everybody's souring investments together without any government regulation or oversight. Well, late today, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner asked congressional leaders for that oversight, a law regulating derivatives and requiring them to be traded on an exchange like stocks, to reduce risks to the financial system, he said, and to protect investors, because there are still trillions of dollars worth of those weapons of mass destruction, as Warren Buffett once called them, waiting around out there. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 184 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ fell 81 points, 3%. The S&P 500 lost 24 points, 0.2%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewurz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, factory jobs once seemed like a safe bet.
I was even told, you know, hey, you stay here. The union is going to take care of you. And in 30 years, you'll be able to retire.
Not anymore, though. A new job, a new path, the next American dream. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.